Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is March 2nd, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as ever, Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Commentary in its 72nd year as the foremost American monthly of intellectual probity, critical insight, political analysis from a conservative perspective. Join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe for $19.95 for a digital subscription, and $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox every month. Our new issue, March, most popular article we've ever published, Nick Eberstadt's Our Miserable 21st Century. Go read it at CommentaryMagazine.com. It will impress you so much that you will subscribe immediately, which has in fact been the case with hundreds and hundreds of people over the last 2 weeks, as the article has had its impact with more than 750,000 people reading it, most significant readership we've ever had since we went online. Gentlemen, Tuesday night, not even 48 hours ago, Donald Trump wowed a lot of people with a pseudo State of the Nation address that struck a new tone for him of qualified optimism and a sense of ideological balance or tonal balance that many people found very heartening. And in a even more significant departure from Trumpian behavior, the White House did not, or Trump did not, step on the success of the speech. Trump did not tweet yesterday. The White House did not release controversial new details of its controversial new executive order on refugee status and immigration. So it was left to the mainstream media to step on it for them last night, Wednesday night, with a flurry of articles that have everybody in the chattering classes chattering like they haven't chattered in a while. We have stories about Attorney General Jeff Sessions possibly misleading and even conceivably perjuring himself in his confirmation hearing in response to a question from Al Franken about contacts with Russian officials. We've learned since, as a result of leaking, that Sessions himself did have two contacts with the Russian ambassador, Mr. Kislyak, and said that he not only had said that he knew of no such contacts, even though he was a significant surrogate on the campaign. That was story number one. And perhaps I think even more significant was the was a very sketchy story in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, about the raid, the counterterrorism raid in Yemen that cost the life of Ryan Owens, the 36-year-old SEAL who's the tribute to whom by Trump in the Tuesday address with his wife in the gallery was certainly the most powerful moment of the speech, and one of the more powerful moments in a pseudo State of the Union speech we've ever seen. The story in the Washington Post suggesting that the Trump administration had hurriedly approved and had not discussed the full contours and the full dangers of the raid, that it was haphazard and unserious. The main source for this being Obama officials who were contrasting the behavior of the Trump White House with their own wondrous behavior in plotting the and dealing with the counterterrorism raids and drone uses done during the Obama years. Noah, we were having an argument here at the office about the Washington Post story, which I find exceptionally shoddy, which I can explain in a minute. But Noah, you had an interesting theory about how there are two narratives developing, one on the left and one on the right, about this Yemen raid, and that, you know, we certainly not only have we not heard the last of it, we haven't even heard the first of it.
Well, I think you were, as you are, often are, relatively persuasive in your arguments, and I will make my point, I guess, later. But I do think yours is equally valuable, if not more so. The notion here, the idea that there are two competing narratives around this Yemen raid, which I think everybody agrees went bad. We had unexpected amount of resistance in the execution of this. We lost a Navy SEAL. 31 Yemeni civilians were killed over the course of this raid, and there. But the, that's where it ends.
And a U.S. rescue helicopter crashed in the Yemeni desert.
So that's where the consensus kind of ends. The two competing narratives are from the Trump administration that while this thing went bad, according to the president, it's my general's fault. But that General Mattis and others who are speaking with the New York Times believe that there is some very significant intelligence was gathered as a result of this thing. That certain elements of the raid, well, maybe, you know, possibly having gone bad or were necessary, and that it's a welcome correction to an Obama administration approach towards counterterrorism, which eschewed operations on the ground for taking actions from the air and relying primarily on drone strikes and the sacrificing the collection of intelligence. And that's pretty necessary.
We should lay out what that means. In other words, if you use a drone, you're simply flying and assassinating somebody. And if you go in on the ground, you can seize equipment, computers, data, information, according to what we were reading. That was, yeah, and conceivably seize people themselves. And that was apparently the purpose of this raid, was not to take out targets, but rather to develop actionable intelligence on the behavior of Al Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, as it's called, AQAP. And after an initial story from NBC a couple of days after the raid that said that the raid had garnered no useful intelligence, Mattis and others are really hitting back and claiming that that is Mattis is enraged by the claim that no intelligence was gotten,
right,
that in fact significant intelligence was procured. We'll never know, because we'll never know what that intelligence is.
Well, we can suss that out after the second competing narrative, which is that this thing was botched from the beginning. It was rushed. The approval process was, quote, abbreviated, according to the Washington Post. The execution of it was poor. They were tipped off on the people who were targeted were tipped off, and therefore that the raid probably should have been aborted before it was even engaged. Once it was engaged, we don't know what Donald Trump was doing. He was apparently tweeting at the time of this execution of this raid. And then no actionable, quote-unquote, intelligence was gathered. As John just said, the definition of actionable and useful intelligence is relatively subjective. It depends on subject to the interpretation of the person who's viewing the intelligence. So it's kind of hard to gauge that, especially from our remove. But even from close up, I mean, opinions will vary on that sort of thing.
Well, they will. I don't think that's why people are saying that there was no good intelligence gotten from it. That almost everything that is being said in attack against the Trump administration over the last 32 days in these leaks from inside the government is intended to make the Trump administration look bad and to say, we wouldn't have done it this way, whoever we is or whoever the permanent bureaucracy is, or whether these leaks are coming from former Obama officials. This story in particular, and I just want to point out, and Noah's chomping at the bit, but I just want to point out that there is a preposterous elision in this Washington Post story. We know that the raid was approved on a Friday. And according to the story, Trump had three different sessions in which he discussed it, in which it was approved, in which he sat in on another meeting about it, one in the morning, one in then NSA Michael Flynn's office, and then something at night, at which point he approved it at Mattis's urging. That was a Friday night. On Saturday, and this is the detail that irritates me, so on Saturday, according to the Washington Post, there was a meeting of the deputies of these various agencies led by K.T. McFarland, who was Flynn's deputy, and they discussed the raid for 25 to 40 minutes. And Colin Cowell, who was Joe Biden's foreign policy aide, use this to say, you see, when we did this, we had meetings for 2 hours in which we laid out intel maps and we went through the intelligence and we did this and we did that and we did the other thing. And you can see how haphazard they were because they only discussed this for 25 to 40 minutes. But that is nonsense because the raid had already been approved, which means that it had left the hands of the deputies and the White House and the people who were sitting at desks, and it had gone to special ops in the Pentagon as they were actually laying out the plans to do it the following day. So whatever the deputies had to say, it is immaterial. The train had left the station. It was already in the hands of the people who were going to stage the raid. The question is what happened in the days before the 25th when the raid was approved. That's what we don't know. We don't know who did what and how many meetings were had and how the actionable intelligence was handled and all of that.
So I just want to make my point of this argument, which is going to be controversial. So brace yourselves. There's a point is that there's a lot for partisans to chew on here. Both sides. Everybody has details and information that they can chew on. New information is coming out about this raid. We haven't heard the last of it. There will be more information. And one of the moments of Donald Trump's speech, the tribute to a widow of a fallen American soldier, was a brilliant moment, both politically and a morally valiant moment, a noble moment, something that America's Gold Star families and Yellow Ribbon families surely appreciated. It was very deserved. At the same time, there's an element of emotional manipulation here, designed, I believe, to get people to stop talking about something that was an objective disaster. And I don't think, in the fullness of time, that that moment will reflect especially well on the Trump administration, because from what we've hearing about this, it sounds like there's a lot more information out there that we're going to learn about this raid.
Not only do I think we're going to learn more about the raid, but I think Obama officials, defense officials, are going to continue to be a thorn in the side for the Trump administration because, specifically, their sort of hyper-cautiousness throughout the Obama years will now allow them, every time there's any action taken, to say, oh, well, in our case, this is why we sat around and deliberated these things. We didn't rush into judgment. We were, you know, This is what happens when you lean into these things to respond to some sort of emotional need or when you're not thoughtful and professorial and whatnot. I mean, meanwhile, the Obama administration deliberated on things, you know, not for 40 minutes but for years until there was no action to be taken, as in the case of Syria or in the case when there was going to be a strike against Assad in retaliation for his use of chemical weapons, and Obama actually deliberated himself out of action and caused a great calamity here. But I mean, the problem is also that Trump brings all this on himself by not ever taking the blame and saying the buck stops with me and I did something wrong. I mean, that's right.
Well,
that's
it's not clear. I mean, here's the thing. The other way to look at this is, he didn't do anything wrong. This was a military operation in the course of an ongoing war on terror that we are still fighting, according to the decision on September, what was it, September 20th, 2001, to give the president and assume that the nation put the nation on war footing in the war on terror, and active military engagements with the enemy involving boots on the ground are riskier than flying a toy plane with a missile on it. I mean, that's just the fact of the matter. They're riskier. And this went wrong. They were found out. They were going on this raid of the house of this tribal chieftain who was in cahoots with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. He then ran over to another house in his compound, and according to what we're reading, he himself is the person who put the women and children in particular in jeopardy by using the place that they lived as the staging area for his counterattack against the Americans. When the Americans called in air support, the air support had to go to nail the house where they were taking fire, And so that house was destroyed and the people in it were killed. The Yemenis were killed because terrorists hide behind women and children and their skirts. And that's one of the horrors of terrorism, and they do it with their own families. And to expect us to do the due diligence to make sure that we're not killing their wives when they clearly don't care whether their wives are living or dead is one thing. The other thing that happened is that there was a rescue helicopter, and the rescue helicopter could have saved Ryan Owen's life, except that it crashed in the desert, in Osprey. So there were multiple difficulties with this raid, and that's what happens in military operations. Now, I don't think that it speaks well of Trump that he said the military lost Ryan. I mean, the generals lost Ryan, because I don't think the generals lost Ryan. That's not what happened. What happened is that there was an operation on the ground that was approved that went, and then things happen when you do that.
I agree with you completely, but there is a traditional understanding that when things go wrong, regardless of the details, the blame ultimately rests with the president. If it's a Black Hawk Down situation or the wrong strategy in Iraq, whatever it is, if he pulls the trigger, the blame ultimately.
There was a draft memo from the Obama administration that made a little bit of news right after the OBL raid that essentially placed blame on the failure of that raid on General McRaven. And that was a little bit of controversial, but everybody was glowing in the fact.
What you mean that they had pre-prepared?
There was a pre-prepared memo in the event that the OBL raid failed, and it looks a lot. It's very similar. No, it's I remember reporting on it from Mediaite. And it was actually it was implied, and it was very similar to this raid. You know, you had a stealth helicopter that went down. Things went pretty bad. Civilians were killed. You know, that helicopter provided a lot of intelligence to the Pakistanis and the Chinese. So it wasn't a fully wonderful raid, with the exception that it killed the world's number one terrorist at the time, and that was a very very much a welcome situation.
Well,
but
of course,
history doesn't allow presidents to get away with this sort of thing. I mean, the Obama administration could have put McRaven up and court-martialed him. Obama would have gotten the blame.
Yeah, but look, here's the simple fact of the matter. Like, and I'm now talking about Commentary Magazine here. So, Obama used a drone to kill al-Awlaki, another, important al-Qaeda asset. And in the course of this raid, his 16-year-old son, who was an American citizen, was killed. And there was a lot of talk about how this was, you're not allowed to kill America. The military should not be allowed to kill American citizens, particularly ones who haven't, signed up for combat. And so this was a sign of the problem with drones. And we defended the Obama administration against what I think is a horrifyingly spurious charge. Like, al-Awlaki went in hiding in the desert to keep himself from being kept from justice. His elimination from the battlefield was a signature effort to impede the growth of al-Qaeda and its ability to threaten U.S. citizens and others. And the responsibility for the death of his son living in his compound belongs to him under the terms of the Geneva Convention, by the way, which does not allow combatants in war to dress in civilian attire and place themselves among civilian populations, including their own family, which would also explain the moral culpability of the raid here with this Yemeni chieftain going and staging his counterattack in the house in his compound in which his wife and children lived, or his wives and children lived, I think. So this is, so I think we come at this from a morally pristine place. I did not attack Obama, defended Obama. We published a significant piece in the magazine 6 years ago called The Case for Drones on this very subject and on how the use of drones was not only effective but moral, in that it in fact reduced the danger of battlefield casualties and the reduced the threat to civilians astonishingly in relation to the kind of military action that has to be taken when you use boots on the ground. So I just wanted to say that, because I'm not just like here saying, oh, well, Obama said this and Trump said that. What I do think is appalling is this notion that the Washington Post story seemed to suggest that the raid was ill-considered because a meeting after its approval took place at the White House in which it was insufficient time left to discuss it, when whatever discussions they were going to have about it had literally nothing to do with what was going to go on once the raid was staged. And that is unjust, and it is factitious, because it creates the impression of something that simply does not have anything to do with the other. And I think that at some point, this use of former Obama officials, both on the record and off the record, like the Ben Rhodes Network that is clearly helping to drop a lot of dirty dimes all over the place without acknowledging their presence in these stories, the famous nine officials, you know, who – somebody remind me what the nine officials did. Oh, they revealed the FBI contacts with – they revealed the Russian contacts with Flynn. Was that it?
That seems to be the story behind the New York Times story, which you didn't mention.
Yeah, so let's get to the New York Times story.
That, I think, is the quote-unquote network behind that story.
Right. Okay. So all I'm saying is that, you know, the Obama – Democrats who worked for the Obama administration, like Colin Cowell on the record and Ben Rhodes, who was obviously speaking not for attribution and behind the record – are off the record, either even if they're doing it for, you know, what they think are patriotic reasons. The notion that they don't have a rooting interest in the destruction of the Trump administration, the Trump foreign policy, is clearly wrong. And if the media, which I think effectively has a rooting interest in the same, uses them, you know, if it does not wish to be viewed as having a rooting interest, it will start viewing these sorts of things, like what Colin Cowell said, with some skepticism and understanding that this is not, you know, independent analysis of somebody who, you know, really has thought deeply about this. He's a partisan fighter, and there is a partisan fight going on. It's partisan and ideological, but it is also very partisan. Democrats are thinking that if they can get the Trump administration on the ropes, they can hurt the Republicans' chances in 2018 and take Trump out in 2020. And so that is a real spur to action, obviously. And if you're a reporter and you have these people who may have some information in their hands that they've saved from their final days or their final 2 months that they're willing to dribble out, can't blame them. But you need to set this in context. You are getting dirty information from people who are – they're not personally dirty, but their information is dirtied by their objectives, you know, you could just make yourself a tool of their interests, but I don't think you're really supposed to do that, you know. You're supposed to sort of like try to tell the truth as best you can. And this is, I think, where Noah's competing narratives thing comes in. The competing narrative is both of these things can be true. That is to say that the raid may have garnered some valuable intelligence and could have been a botch. And I think ultimately having to say one or the other, having to say it got good intelligence, so it was an unqualified success, having to say not only was it a botch because Ryan Owens died and the plane crashed and all these people died, but also because nothing good came of it. Like it's just caricaturism, you know? That's not the way you try to investigate complex military actions. Having said that, you know, it is a cautionary tale for the Trump White House, which clearly, you know, wanted to make, or the Trump administration, which clearly wanted to do something fast and serious to show that they were serious about the war on terror.
You know, and I think it also just needs to be said, because this brings up something that I think came out a lot during the Bush years. The idea that when an American dies or Americans die in a military operation that went wrong, the idea that therefore their participation, their lives were wasted on an action that went wrong, is itself to me dangerous and disgusting. If an operation that goes wrong in part of a larger operation that does part of a larger strategy that does a lot of good and that saves American lives is not a life that is wasted. Now, ironically, Trump sort of established some of this bad precedent during his campaign by saying things like, I like the military heroes who aren't caught, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's own form of very disgusting manipulation to wait for things to go wrong and say, oh, well, look at the life that was wasted in this bad operation.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a complex moral calculation about war, and it also speaks to Noah said that the moment in the speech paying tribute both to Ryan Owens and to his wife Karen was both masterly and a form of emotional manipulation. And sometimes the emotional manipulation is a good thing, not a bad thing, which is to say that forcing Democrats who are acting childish during the Trump, you know, acting as though, you know, they are never going to, you know, they can't even stop looking like they sucked on a lemon while Trump says totally anodyne things about the future of the country, forcing them to stand up to pay tribute to a fallen American, and even if his purpose or if the ultimate Machiavellian purpose would have been to shut people up and not have them really look too deeply into the raid, has its own value. Because, you know, their behavior was just shockingly inappropriate during the entire speech. I understand they hate him. I understand that the line on the left is that he's, you know, he's about to, you know, this is all the Reichstag fire and he's a Nazi about to overthrow everything. But, you know, though, you know, one congressman famously shouted out, "You lie," when Obama spoke. A lot of people on the right thought Obama was a new kind of dictator, and they managed to be civil during his, you know, during his addresses before a joint session of Congress, and so should Democrats be able to be civil during Trump's address to Congress.
But the Republicans didn't get very well received when they went back home for behaving civilly towards what the grassroots believed to be was somebody who was a fundamentally un-American approach to governance and who was some sort of a usurper, and as a result they had a lot of problems back home.
Okay, fair enough. And that's of course the story of Elliot Engel, the congressman from the Bronx and Westchester, who, you know, has for 30 years positioned himself, you know, on the aisle so that he could be the first person or the last person to shake the president's hand. And Elliot, who's a nice guy and, you know, basically is a moderate to conservative Democrat, decided the last thing he could possibly do this time was to sit there and do this with Trump, because if you ever saw anybody who could be primaried and defeated in his, you know, Elliot Engel would be such a person. The party has moved way to his left, and particularly on his district is a weird district, and so he didn't need that. He didn't need to turn into the Joe Lieberman of 2018. You know, if you remember, Joe Lieberman's entire, you know, there was a primary challenge to Joe Lieberman largely as a result of the fact that Bush gave him a kiss on the cheek when he at the 2006 inaugural
address. Democrats
mocked
Republicans for primarying Charlie Crist over a hug and falling out of love with Chris Christie over a hug.
I'm not talking about a hug. I'm just saying, like, you know, saying we're all in this together. You know, you can like applaud when somebody says that. You know,
but just to reiterate that the Obama administration did that sort of emotional manipulation, and probably the Bush administration too, I guess you could make that case, sort of emotionally manipulative effort to shut up your critics over of what could be something that's very serious if it were investigated. And I don't think we've heard the last of the Yemen raid.
Yeah, but we were saying before that, you know, there was a kind of fight. I mean, this is not seemly, but this is life. Like, there was this fight over Ambassador Chris Stevens' body. I mean, in some sense, literally, because, you know, Obama and Hillary went to Dover Air Force Base to see the body when it came in, but also because Hillary got all huffy with the House Committee investigating with the Senate Committee investigating the Benghazi raid by saying, you know, Chris Stevens was a friend of mine. How dare you? You know, what difference does all that make at this point? He's dead. It's so awful. You know, and then of course, when the right took up the Benghazi cudgel, it was 4 Americans died and they don't care and they didn't care and they wanted them to die because they didn't send, you know, rescue mission to help them. And they did this and they did blah, 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 blah,
and
blah.
She
blah,
lied
blah,
over
blah.
Their bodies, which she did.
So I'm just saying that you know, having fights over the corpses of the dead has become a sad feature of our politics.
And I think that's a cautionary tale for this administration, because it wasn't the Obama administration that came out of that looking great. even though they accused Republicans of being.
Well, if you lived in the Obama bubble, you did think it came out great. Right. We're just saying, like, it's like the funny thing about Benghazi and the hearings on Benghazi is the following, which is that Hillary finally went and she spent 11 hours before that committee on Benghazi, and it was like, she did so great. She showed them. She did. She was like masterful, and they didn't lay a glove on her. And I think it's inarguable that the Benghazi hearing that was staged against her was the reason that she lost the presidency. I mean, you could trace the email. You know, it was the Benghazi
investigation.
The Select Committee investigation. Yeah. Select Committee investigation. That was who she that's whom she testified before for those 11 hours. Uncovered the email system that led to her defeat. It's impossible to see how her defeat – the importance of that discovery and her behavior in relation to that discovery was the key to her loss. And now this brings us to Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. But before we discuss Attorney General Jeff Beauregard Sessions, we should talk about Simply Safe. Simply Safe, one of our sponsors. Know what's going on. I heard an alarming story out of California recently. A woman was hired to clean homes, was stealing from them at the same time. Imagine that. You pay someone to help take care of your home, and they burglarize you, Noah. Can you believe that? How do you protect yourself from something like this? A regular security system won't protect you from the people you know and trust, Abe. Here's what you do. You get Simply Safe. Simply Safe makes it possible to know what's going on at home. If you want to check in, just live stream footage from the Simply Safe camera directly to your smartphone anytime you want. You can get text message and email alerts when someone arms or disarms your system, so you'll be sure, confident that your home is safe. For 24/7 protection you can really trust, go to simplisafe.com/ricochet. That's SIMPLISAFE.com/ricochet. Order a Simply Safe home security system today. Excuse me, Simply Safe home security system today. And you'll even get a special 10% discount. Go now, simplisafe.com/ricochet. SIMPLISAFE.com/ricochet. RICOCHET. Thanks so much to Simply Safe. So, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is in a pickle. Why is he in a pickle? Because the New York, because everybody, or a lot of people, whatever, revealed last night that he had told that though he had told Al Franken during his confirmation hearing that he had had no dealings with the Russian officials before the election that in fact he had had at least two such meetings with the Russian ambassador to the United States, Mr. Kislyak, one at the Republican National Convention and one either a phone call or some meeting in September, something like that. And if you listen very closely to the Franken exchange, Franken says, are you aware of ongoing connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians? And Sessions says, well, you know, a lot of people have called me a surrogate a time or two about this, relation to the campaign. I'm aware of no such meetings. I didn't have them. I'm aware of no such meetings, and I can't comment on it. So the Talmudic interpretation is, or the Straussian esoteric interpretation, or however you want to call it, is that he did not say that he did not have meetings with the Russians. He said he did not have meetings with the Russians as a surrogate of the Trump campaign. And the line that is being proffered in his defense is that, yes, he had meetings with the Russians as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in which capacity he certainly has every right to meet with Russians. Having said that, 20 of the 26 senators on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee were contacted by the Washington Post, I think.
I think it was Armed Services.
Oh, excuse me, Armed Services Committee, I apologize, were contacted by the Washington Post and said they had not met with Kislyak that year. And so it was apparently unusual, not usual, for a senator to have such a meeting or two. So immediately every Democrat in America is calling for Sessions to resign and, you know, commit seppuku and, you know, basically go to Leavenworth and lock himself in jail for the rest of his life. And increasingly, Republicans, including the House Majority Leader and Senator Rob Portman and others, are saying that Sessions will clearly have to recuse himself from any investigation into the connection between the Trump campaign and the Russians, which is significant, by the way, because as Attorney General, if he has to recuse himself, that suggests that the that is itself a suggestion that there will have to be an independent counsel or a special prosecutor in the matter, since he cannot supervise. If he recuses himself, he cannot then supervise the case. As we know from 6, 7, 8 months ago, when the Attorney General announced she was recusing herself from a key Justice Department decision, Jim Comey came out and said that he was not going to indict Hillary, or he was not going to recommend an indictment of Hillary, but that, you know, she should have been indicted, really, but he shouldn't, but no one would have indicted her except she did all these terrible things. And Lynch did that, of course, because she had that plane meeting with Bill Clinton the week before. So it's not good to try to recuse yourself and then have the ordinary Justice Department procedure go on. It doesn't work. So how serious is the Sessions problem, Abe?
For him, it's, I think, remarkably serious. And I think much like the Washington Post case regarding the Yemen raid, there's a chance that this isn't the end of it also. What better way if there's more excuse me, if there's more information about Sessions having met with Kislyak or with anyone else from Russia, why leak that all out at once? I mean, what better way to tie him up than to string that out over the coming weeks and months? So, and by the way, I don't know if there is or not, but if there is, he knows, and he's got to factor that into his decision.
There probably
as well.
Is.
Right. Very, very possibly.
So I read this story the second I clicked X on the New York Times story last night about this alleged trail of intelligence that has been left by the Obama administration for investigators. And lo and behold, we have regarding contracts with Russia, and then all of a sudden this pops up. So the thing that got Flynn was he contended when the calls, but he said he didn't have any contact with Kislyak. It was actually Kislyak. And he said he had no contact with these people. And then it came out that he did have contact with them. So Sean Spicer, White House press secretary, says, well, it was kind of routine contacts. All they were talking about, they texted each other Merry Christmas. And then they had a phone conversation about very routine setting up a conversation between the president-elect at the time and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Well, it turns out, according to transcripts that have been reported by the New York Times and others, to which we can assume they were privy, regarding these conversations, were about sanctions relief. And those conversations were apparently taped and transcribed and are in the possession of members of the Intelligence Committee. One of the meetings between Sessions and this Russian ambassador was at the GOP convention. That seems kind of untoward, but it's actually not really that big a deal because the State Department allows and has a program providing ambassadors access to things like that so they can view democracy in its rawest form. But if there's a phone call and it's transcribed because the intelligence community monitors telephone conversations between Americans that go in and out of the Russian ambassador, the ambassador's residence or the embassy, then it's in somebody's possession, and somebody has it, and somebody might be privy to it.
Well, let me just give you the reason that Session is screwed, no matter what happens. Okay, so three different scenarios. One is he recuses himself, and there's an independent counsel investigation, and there is a his comments to Franken become one of the subjects of this question of whether or not he intentionally misled and he was under oath and was that perjury or was it not perjury and what rises to the standard of perjury and all of that. So Sessions, who is not a wealthy man, has to lawyer up. He's got to get a lawyer, and this is going to go on for 2 years, let's say. So he'll have hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal bills while on his government salary, which is probably less than $200,000. so and we'll have multiple meetings and have to be briefed and debriefed and this and that and the other thing. And meanwhile, this is all going on. So that's one form of screwing. Then the other form of screwing is that he finds it necessary to, most extreme, he finds it necessary to resign. Or the administration fires him, or he quits because he doesn't want to be a distraction. The problem is that then there will be an independent counsel, and he will have to lawyer up, and he will have hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal bills, and he'll everything that just happened to him when he recused himself but remained attorney general would happen to him in that case. And the third case, it's that he says, the hell with you, I didn't do anything wrong, and so I'm there's going to be an investigation in the Justice Department, and you know, and that's it. In which case, there will be a story every single day dribbling out. Stuff will come out through the Democrats in the House from Justice Department and intelligence leaks. And there will be an independent counsel eventually, and he'll have to resign, or he'll have to recuse himself, and he'll have hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal bills, and he'll have to lawyer up, and he'll so basically, he's screwed. From this moment onward, he's screwed. This is now part of his life. It will be a consuming preoccupation of his life. He will be an inefficient attorney general as a result, and that's life.
He's got one way out then.
What's that?
Defection. straight to Moscow.
Right. Now, here's the point. I am sorry. I would very much like to join the chorus of people on the right who are saying that this is unjust and that he – and it, there's no crime. He met with the guy. It's anyone can meet with anybody. Who the hell are you to say not? I've watched the clip of him with Franken six times now, and he's lying. I mean, as I say, or he's either misleading or he's lying. Because you don't forget a conversation with a guy named Kislyak with a big, thick Russian accent, particularly if it's happening in the heat of a campaign in which there is daily attention being paid to the question of whether or not WikiLeaks is a Russian operation and it's leaking stuff about the DNC to harm Hillary and to screw the Democrats. So
the White House initially said that there was no conversation about the campaign, and then they kind of said, "Well, it came up at the top."
Right. So I don't believe. You know, so basically, was he misleading? Yes. Now, all I'm saying is, I'm sorry, I'm not defending that. You can defend it all you like. People can say this is what politicians do and all that. But as a simple practical matter, I don't want my attorney general lying in his confirmation hearing. And that's all there is to it. And maybe it means nothing. And maybe he should apologize and say that he just didn't want to get Trump in trouble because it was such a headline thing. And his contacts were entirely innocent, but he just thought he would brave through, which would be one way of handling it. But I am not going to sit here and defend him for a clear prevarication that I've seen myself with my own eyes.
So the Washington Post, Jen Rubin, had a good point. She said maybe it would be better for Trump if he did resign, because if he were to put this in the hands of an independent prosecutor, like you said, you don't know where that sort of thing goes. And he's sort of neutered now as an effective attorney general, so maybe he should resign. And that sort of makes a lot of sense, especially if you think that this administration is better served when the originals, quote unquote, are defenestrated. McMaster's NSA is already markedly more competent than anything we saw out of Flynn's NSA. I mean, the Decius Publius Maius, Augustus Caesars of the world will be very frustrated by that. But the rest of us who want to see a functional working American government in the White House should be pretty happy about it.
Well, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. I was just saying Sessions was screwed, not necessarily that, you know,
but that the Trump administration might want to consider. I mean, it will be a really ugly news cycle for them, but in the ultimately
it would not be an ugly news cycle for Trump if he fired Sessions. That's actually the interesting aspect of what happened this week, and we can kind of close on this, which is he got really, really good reviews for the speech, including from me. He likes getting good reviews.
But you know that's what's going to be.
From who?
But what's everyone.
From everybody.
Yeah. But I think what's going to be telling now is, so he took the high road during his speech. Remarkably, he's laid off Twitter. Does this do the new barrage of stories draw him back out? Does he return to form now? Does he go on to Twitter and say the failing New York Times is lying about a good man? Sad. Et cetera, et cetera. In which case, he will not be firing anyone.
Listen, if that speech was an indication. I don't know who. I don't know why. I don't know how. That he is taking some lessons from Ronald Reagan, which is to say that the speech featured very little use of the word "I," the word with which he begins literally almost every sentence he ever speaks. That was a very significant Reagan trope that the presidents who followed him have found very difficult to match. Reagan never referred to himself in the first person, and it was we, and it was the nation, and he was just a steward of the nation, and it created a very significant unifying tone. Trump struck that Reaganite tone, struck this kind of remarkably optimistic tone about what the nation could be like on its 250th birthday, which happens not so coincidentally to fall a year, in theory, a year after he would finish his eighth year as president, and how stunning it was on the 100th anniversary of the United States when there was an exposition, when it was clear that America was the technological leader of the world in 1876, and could we not, what wonders could we present to the world in 2026 when we, you know, if we get ourselves on the right track. It was really a wonderful trope. So I'm mentioning this to say that Reagan was incredibly cold-blooded about his staff and about people who worked for him. And when things went wrong, including with the mother of Trump's current Supreme Court nominee, and Gorsuch Burford, who was Secretary of the Interior, I think. Anyway, she got into some trouble and was basically thrown out the window, because that's what you have to do. And Reagan, wonderful guy, did not have any loyalty, went up, did not go down. That was a key understanding in the Reagan White House and the Reagan administration. It seemed unfair. Trump, who supposedly likes chaos and all of that, Trump should learn that lesson. It's an important lesson for presidencies and their efficiency that, you know, it's a bigger job than people. It's not about them. It's about the country. And if they become inefficient, even if it's unfair, even if it's unjust, even if it's bad, you cut them loose, because you just can't go on with the nonsense.
You know, I think this comes down to a fundamental tension in the administration that's going to be resolved one way or the other. And that's that Steve Bannon wants to be hated. Trump very desperately wants to be loved. And that's
well, in Machiavellian terms, Bannon wants to be feared, right? The Machiavellian thing is it's better to be feared than loved. Bannon wants to be feared and believes that he can never be loved. And Trump likes to be feared but would probably rather be loved, or loved and feared in equal measure, let's say.
I also think Bannon enjoys being hated. I think he thinks that knocks your enemy off kilter.
Yes, nobody talks about admiring Satan and the dark arts because they're vying for your affections.
I don't know. Most people really, really don't like getting bad press and being called terrible things.
I agree.
If they say, I wear the hatred of the New York Times as a badge of honor, you know, that's probably not really true. It's not that you need to be loved by the New York Times, but you certainly don't. You know, maybe you handle it that way, but it's true that these are the two faces that, you know, that Bannon understands Trump's administration to be a giant intellectual and political and ideological project, and Trump shows no understanding that that's what it is. He just wants to make sure that his voters, you know, get stuff, and that he makes good deals, that he can walk around saying, I made everything better, and look, Carrier got 5,000 jobs. And does he want to be loved by the New York Times? Absolutely he does. Absolutely he does. He doesn't – I don't think he's going to grow an office to do it, because I think he understands that he'll never get loved that way. But if they say his speech was good, that is like ambrosia to him. And if
– he's got to be spitting nails, though, because he, for the first time in – who knows how long, maybe ever, of the course of his political career, they leaned back, they let the news cycle mature on its own, they didn't feed the narrative, he didn't indulge in any of this, he did it all quietly and just because I kind of let it happen. And what do they get for it? they get a terrible news cycle, less than 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't get – I mean, speeches don't have a half-life that long. And the whole question was whether – and this is what the next week will show – whether the new tone that the speech took was simply a one-off, you know, and like a fluke and a stunt, and whether it did not or whether it was a signal that this period of being in a constant state of, you know, angry, pissed off embattlement, you know, was going to move on with him accepting the fact that he is the leader of the free world and has resources to do things and affect things and change things, and doesn't need to get into, you know, fights with, you know, SNL. But we'll see whether he is triggered by what's happening here. In fact, you could even say, well, he'll be triggered properly, because the triggering will be that there was this assault on this person who was an early endorser and supporter of his, and he's not going to take it lying down. But I'm saying he should take it lying down, that is a short-term, as Noah would say about the handling of Ryan Owens in the speech, that was short-term gain that might have long-term parlous consequences, maybe a little like the mission accomplished banner or something like that. And it would be a short-term gain for him to be given points for loyalty for Sessions, possibly sacrificing the long-term gain of getting Sessions out of there and getting somebody else in, like Mike Mukasey, you know, whom he could appoint attorney general again, something like that, someone of unimpeachable integrity who didn't have contacts with Russians.
This is the swamp. This is the swamp rising.
Oh, really? Well, Mike Mukasey came in to save Bush from the swamp. That was Mike Mukasey
was his solution to the cable.
Alberto Gonzalez problem.
He was on cable, tamping down one of these controversies recently.
Mukasey was sitting behind Sessions in that clip with, he testified for Sessions. Anyway, this just popped into my head. The last thing I want to say is a story came out in Business Insider that Oprah is considering the 2020 nomination for the presidency of candidacy of the Democratic Party. And I said it here first on the day after the election. I said the Democrats have one way and one way only to go in 2020. It's Oprah. And I'm saying that now because I want to remind you, Pete, so that I get credit, because I deserve the credit. I said it for 6 months beforehand, but I didn't say we weren't podcasting then. Or if we were, it didn't come up. And this is my idea, and I don't want anybody else to get credit for it when she does it and beats him. That's all I'm saying.
You sure you don't want anyone else to get credit for it?
For
an Oprah presidency?
No, I don't want credit for the Oprah presidency. I want credit for the visionary understanding that the country has gone so far down this, you know, road of confusing reality television with reality, that she is the perfect person to be the challenger to him. And with that, we come with that self-aggrandizing and slightly pitiable and depressing effort to, you know, garner some, attention from people who are already listening to this. And so I think you probably already like us okay. So I'm now feeling embarrassed that I just did that anyway, but I did it on Twitter yesterday, so I figured I needed to say something here today. We come to an end of this week's podcasts. For Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I am John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.